Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
So please help me welcome to the stage my great friend and great community partner, Rob Gordon.
Thank you, Elise. If you've been around Nashville for a long time, you know that WPLN was part of the Nashville Public Library, and the P and the L in our name evoke that heritage of public library. And we would not have been able to go independent without the help of a lot of people, some of whom are in this room. I want to do one thing before I bring Steve out, which is to identify our own Steve Inskeep, and I'm referring to Emil Moffitt. Emil, where are you sitting? Emil is the voice of WPLN's Morning Edition. He is the guy who gets up early so that you don't have to. Wait a minute. That doesn't quite work. But anyway, we're so glad to have the opportunity to welcome Steve Inskeep to Nashville. Steve began his career at Morning Edition in 2004. He is he grew up in Carmel, Indiana. And he went to Morehead State University in Kentucky. He is the co-host of Morning Edition, along with Renee Montaigne and David Green. I know that all of you feel a sense of intimacy with the person you wake up next to, and I know that you will not be disappointed when you meet and hear Steve. Steve is the author of two books. Some of you came to his book signing earlier. His first book is called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, Pakistan, based on his reporting out of Pakistan. And the book that we're going to hear about tonight, Jackson Land, which is an amazing book and which really rings true, has special meaning for those of us who live in Middle Tennessee. It's a great honor for me to have been asked to introduce Steve Inskeep. He is a friend, and he's one of the great voices and great personalities and journalists for public radio. Please welcome, I don't see him yet. There he is, Steve Inskeep.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. It's an honor to be here on this stage. It is good that Emil is here, your local Morning Edition host. Just so you know, this is how it's going to work. I will talk for quite some time, but every few minutes he will interrupt with traffic and weather and local news, just so that you're comfortable and feel like things are normal. It is great to be here. It's great to be introduced by the two people that I was just introduced by. I just want to mention, you know, I get to travel to a lot of communities across this country, and there are two things that I think are among the things that are vital to have a vibrant, strong, lively community. One is a great public radio station. Another is a great public library. And you guys are well served. If you want to have a vibrant community, it also helps to be Nashville. So it is great to be here this evening. This is a story, this book, effectively of two Tennessee characters. One, Andrew Jackson, the other, John Ross, who lived most of his life in Georgia, but many of you may know that Chattanooga's original name was Ross's Landing, and it's connected to him. Before I talk about it, I just want to mention that Tennesseans were very helpful in researching this book. The mistakes are mine, but many things that may be correct can be traced back to Tennesseans. The Andrew Jackson Papers Project at the University of Tennessee is an awesome project, and I went through many of those papers that they have gone through, and it was tremendously helpful to me. And I also want to mention that in going through this story, I wanted to have different kinds of people read parts of the manuscript. It's a story about Native Americans. I had a friend who was Native American read large parts of the manuscript. And it's a story about Andrew Jackson, so I tried to think of a military guy from Tennessee. And there's a man named Andrew Exum, who read parts of the book for me He's a guy who you should know his name. He's from Tennessee. He's served in the military abroad in recent years. He's continued to serve his country in think tanks as a scholar. He's now been reappointed back into the U.S. government, and I mention him particularly because I believe his mom is here. Ann Exum, would you stand up for a moment, please? Thanks to all of you for being here tonight. This is a story of the American South. In a broader sense, it's the story of the creation of America, but I'm happy to say that it is, for people in this region, a local story. And we could look all around this region and find signs of this story, the creation of this region, which happened in the early 19th century. We don't have to go any farther than the Hermitage, do we? We could also go to Florence, Alabama, in the northern part of the state, on the banks of the Tennessee River and just outside of town. I took this photo. These columns are the ruins of a mansion called Forks of Cypress. That mansion was a plantation house. It was built by a friend of Andrew Jackson on land that Andrew Jackson obtained from Cherokees. And that's what our story is about. It's about capturing Indian land and creating a new world on that land. It's still a working farm, by the way. People live amid history. It's still a working farm, and I went there, and the son of the owner was there, and I asked if he wouldn't mind if I walked around taking photographs, and he said, sure, that's fine. And then he looked down and saw that I was wearing shorts and no socks and said, just watch out for the snakes. But it turned out okay. Our two main characters, the first one is quite familiar here, Andrew Jackson, victor of the Battle of New Orleans, among other battles, a hero of early American democracy, a man who was born in very humble circumstances in 1767. His father died shortly before he was born. His mother died when he was quite young during the Revolutionary War. He was an orphan. And he rose to be president of the United States. No one from such modest circumstances had ever risen so far at the time he was elected in 1828. But there were aspects of his vast and amazing career that brought him into conflict with our other main character. This is John Ross. He was Cherokee, a man of mixed race. You can see the clothing there, which tells you something about the Cherokees of his time. He's not dressed in traditional Cherokee clothes. He's dressed like a white man. He was a man who rose to leadership of the Cherokee Nation at a time when Cherokees lived in the southern Appalachians, not far from here, and at a time when white settlement was spreading rapidly westward across the countryside, and Cherokees were attempting to adapt. Their elites particularly adopted white men's clothes, Western forms or American forms of agriculture, if you will. They changed their economy. They changed their education. They adopted education. They adopted a system of writing for themselves, and many of them also learned to write in English. And John Ross was the man who rose at a relatively young age to become the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. It's a story that takes place almost 200 years ago, in some cases, in fact, more than 200 years ago, but that came to me to feel very modern and very present. The events in this book are to me at once very distant and very immediate and relatable. And an example of this comes in 1812, when John Ross, at the age of 22, gets on a boat. Let's bring up a map here, just so that we can follow along. Whoops, one too many. But we see the Tennessee River. That's that squiggly line that goes up and down through the state of Tennessee, up and down again. John Ross went on a boat ride down that river. His intent was to go downriver to the Ohio down the Ohio a little ways, down the Mississippi, and then up the Arkansas. He intended, with three other men, to go trading. There were Cherokees then living west of the Mississippi, and he had a boatload of trade goods. And they were going down the Tennessee River. Anyone covertly studying that boat would have seen four men on board. John Ross was black-haired, brown-eyed, slight but handsome. Each of his three companions could be described in a phrase: a Cherokee interpreter, an older Cherokee man named Calcity, and a servant. But Ross was harder to categorize. He was the son of a Scottish trader whose family had lived among Cherokees for generations in their homeland in the southern Appalachians. Ross was an aspiring trader himself. Yet he also had a solid claim to his identity as an Indian. A man of mixed race, he had grown up among Cherokee children and, in keeping with Cherokee custom, received a new name at adulthood, Kooskooey, said to be a species of bird. Whether he was a white man or an Indian became a matter of life and death on December 28, 2012. December 28, 1812. He didn't live quite that long a life. In Kentucky, as Ross later recorded in a letter, we was hailed by a party of white men. The men on the riverbank called for the boat to come closer. Ross asked what they wanted. "Give us the news," one called back. Something bothered Ross about the men. "I told them we had no news worth their attention." Now the white men revealed their true purpose. One shouted that they had orders from a garrison of soldiers nearby to stop every boat descending the river to examine if any Indians was on board, as they were not permitted to come about that place. "Come to us," the men concluded, "or we'll come to you." Ross didn't come. "Damn my soul if those two are not Indians," one of the men shouted, referring to two of Ross's crew. The man added that he would gather a company of men to pursue and kill them. Ross came up with an answer. "These two men are Spaniard," he said. The white men demanded the Spaniards prove their identity by speaking Spanish. Peter, the servant, actually could, but the white men still insisted it was an Indian boat and mounted their horses and galloped off. Ross had to assume the white men were serious. The United States had declared war on Britain that year, and some native nations had joined the British side, killing white settlers, fighting alongside British troops, and throwing the frontier into turmoil. The white horsemen would not pause to find out that Ross's Cherokees were loyal to the United States. The Cherokees could travel in only one direction, downstream, and would have little chance to escape if the men on horseback arranged an unpleasant reception. Ross decided on a precaution. He whitened the boat. He had told the horsemen there were no Indians on board, and the best chance of safety was to make this claim appear true. He modified the racial composition of his crew, leaving only those who could pass as non-Indian. Ross could pass, as could the Cherokee interpreter, who, like Ross, was an English speaker and a mixed blood, parlance for part white and part Indian. The servant, likely a black man, would be ignored. Only old Calcity was a full-blooded Cherokee with no chance to fool anybody. His mere presence might even cause the others to be perceived as Indians. This apparently was Ross's thinking because, as he confided later, "We concluded it was good policy to let Calcity out of the boat." The old man would have to set off overland and meet the craft later. The remaining crew put their poles in the water and shoved the keelboat toward whatever lay ahead. Ross spent two anxious days on the water, and Calcity had a disagreeable walk of about 30 miles, probably along the bank opposite from where they'd seen the horsemen. Finally, the old man rejoined the boat downstream, and they all floated to a safe haven Fort Massac on the Ohio River, manned by professional soldiers who could tell friend from foe. The horseman never reappeared. Reflecting on this afterward, Ross said he was convinced that the independent manner in which I answered the horseman had confounded their apprehension of it being an Indian boat. Indians were supposed to be children of the woods, in a common phrase of the era, dangerous, but not too bright, and expected to address white men respectfully as elder brothers. Ross had talked back to the man in clear and defiant English. The future leader of the Cherokee Nation had passed as white. This, to me, is a very modern story in this rapidly changing country with so many different kinds of people. A man of mixed race who effectively has more than one identity, can lean toward his white side, can lean toward his Indian side, feels pressured to do so in certain situations, and do what he has to survive. Ross did that. He was also a persistent guy who, after this strange episode, continued downriver and then up the Arkansas River and did his trading and went back. Back to the southern Appalachians in time to join an army. He was part of a military unit called the Cherokee Regiment, which was eventually attached to the army of General Andrew Jackson. Our two main characters were on the same side at the beginning. There were, at this time, Indian nations and rebel factions that wanted out of the United States, that had never conceded any reliance or dependence on the United States, wanted the white men to go away. Tecumseh is perhaps the most famous of the era. The Cherokees wanted something else. They didn't want out, they wanted in. John Ross, a couple of years after the war, wrote a letter to a U.S. government official in which he said, "We consider ourselves a part of the great family of the Republic of the United States." And so we have here a racial minority who wanted in to this rapidly growing country that was flooding them and surrounding them with new settlers. I came to think of the Cherokees like immigrants assimilating to a new country, except the new country was coming to them. This very quickly would bring John Ross into conflict with Andrew Jackson, who remained a general after the war, was in charge of affairs in the American South, and who found himself with the duty, as he saw it, to impose a new reality on this region. This I've labeled the white man's map. We could have just called it the map of the United States. That's what it is, in 1812. And everything looks very familiar here, doesn't it? We see Tennessee, it's its normal shape. We see the Carolinas, we see Georgia. Some things look a little different than today, but you can see that map emerging. Mississippi Territory is what's going to become Mississippi and Alabama, for example. This is the map of the United States. I call it the white man's map because the same territory, particularly in the South, could be represented on a different, mutually exclusive map that I call the Indian map. Here you see the same territory, but with Indian nations on it. Five Indian nations, the Cherokees, the Creeks, the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, and the Seminoles in what was then Spanish Florida. And you'll notice that the states, some of them are different shapes. Tennessee's a lot smaller. Kentucky's a little bit smaller. Mississippi Territory, those two future states, hardly exists at all. Georgia is just a little strip along the coast and up the river there. The interior is owned by Indians. It's a completely different map. And the irony of that moment in history is that the United States government recognized both mutually exclusive maps. And in fact, once this issue finally got before the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court would rule, in effect, that this was the legal map. This was the legal map. The conflict that Andrew Jackson and John Ross would wage over a course of more than 20 years was in effect over which map would prevail, who would own the territory. Jackson is one of the most amazing figures in American history to study because he lived such a long and crowded life. Biographers have a tendency to dive into Andrew Jackson and become obsessed and write multi-volume histories when they meant to just write a little. There is so much to say. There's so much to say about his early life, about his middle age, about his presidency. It was remarkable for me to realize that he did not truly rise to national fame until he was in his late 40s, 47 or so. Since I'm about to turn 47, I rather like that part. But he was a man, up until then, with a checkered reputation. He had been Tennessee's first member of the House of Representatives. He'd been a senator. He had done things. But he was a politician, and without the best reputation at all. Controversy followed the whip-thin politician with the wiry hair. Although his ownership of slaves was unremarkable in Tennessee, he sometimes engaged in slave dealing, a business that even slave owners considered disreputable. He also endured criticism for his continuing tendency to challenge other men to duels, a practice that remained common but illegal. I want you to know, by the way, that Andrew Jackson spent much of his adult life, including years in the White House, with two bullets in his body. Neither were from war. They were from his social interactions. In 1806, Jackson let an exchange of insults with a Nashville man escalate into a duel and resolved to kill his opponent. Jackson let the other man shoot first, took a lead ball near his heart that would remain in his body the rest of his life, yet remained standing, according to accounts of this duel. He took time to be sure of his aim before firing a fatal shot in return. Unfortunately for Jackson, his antagonist was a popular young man whose death stained Jackson's reputation, and that reputation was already colored by scandal. It was widely known that he had been together with Rachel, his wife, for years before she completed her divorce from an abusive husband. Rachel and Andrew lived as husband and wife from 1790 or 91 onward, even though the formal decree ending her previous marriage did not arrive until 1793. They had to be remarried in order to clear up doubts about their status. But having married, they cultivated a conventional family life. With no children of their own, they adopted their son, Andrew Jr., from Rachel's relatives. When Jackson traveled, his miserable wife wrote him letters urging him to hurry home. He wrote back tenderly to express regret that he could not. The muddled circumstances of his marriage proved to be characteristic of Jackson. He took counsel of what he wanted, what his friends desired, and what he felt to be right. He was guided less by the norms of society than by what he considered just, as he wrote in his letters, often capitalizing the word. For his marriage to Rachel, the most romantic act of his life, he was willing to endure decades of whispers and insults. A darker manifestation of this characteristic came out in Jackson's slave trading. The social convention that it was acceptable to own human beings as property, but that only low-down characters would engage in the slave trade, would have been just the sort of elaborate hypocrisy by which Jackson refused to be governed. Modern readers can wish that he resolved this hypocrisy by rejecting both practices. Instead, he embraced both when it suited his interests. His approach to slavery foreshadowed his approach to federal Indian policy. He would reject what he saw as its false piety and rewrite the policy in a way that suited people like himself. Until the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in 1814, the record of Jackson's career suggests a talented man thrashing about in the dark, trying to locate a ladder that no man of his background had ever climbed. His speeches made an impression in the House of Representatives, but he left his seat. He served briefly in the Senate, but resigned and went home, becoming a justice on the Tennessee Supreme Court. He won election in 1802 as a major general in command of the Tennessee militia, but for years he found no wars to fight. Like many a Westerner, and as everyone in this room knows, in the early years of the country, Tennessee was the West. Like many a Westerner, he speculated in land. He bought and sold the rights to tens of thousands of acres, including land alongside the Mississippi River that eventually became Memphis. It was common for speculators to buy the rights to Indian land and then press their politicians to clear it of Indians, pressure that Jackson, as a politician himself, was well connected to apply. But he made the mistake of dealing with men more dreamy-eyed than he was. And when one of his land sales unraveled, Jackson struggled to avoid bankruptcy and the risk of debtor's prison. That was long before the War of 1812, when his military and diplomatic triumphs opened new horizons for a man with a real estate background and business connections. During that war, he was a general in command of an army. When it was over, he applied his relentless energy to the conquest of acreage. And that is the heart of the story in Jacksonland. It is two men fighting over real estate in a democracy. And it's that last part about democracy that really, really draws me into this story, that makes it vitally important to me. Your congressman is here tonight, Congressman Cooper. Yeah, there he is. You can applaud the man. It's okay. This will no doubt surprise Congressman Cooper and others. I cover politics, and occasionally it's a little frustrating. Present company accepted, sir. And my frustration a few years ago drove me back into history. I wanted to better understand how our democratic system developed. It developed in the early 19th century. Many of our modern institutions developed then. We moved from being more of a republic, which can take many forms, actually, to being a more democratic society, with institutions like a very active news media and a two-party system and many other things. This was happening in the early 19th century, and I became very interested in this story for that reason. We have here Andrew Jackson, the hero of that era, the hero of early American democracy, who for more than 20 years as a general and then as president of the United States consistently pursued a goal of erasing those Indian nations off the map. He did it in war. He did it by treaty. He did it with legislation as president. It was his first major legislative initiative as president of the United States, was a proposal that became known as the Indian Removal Act, which really doesn't sound good today. It did not, as some people say, order Indians to leave, but it did create conditions that would make it difficult for them to stay and offer them transportation west. That was a central project of Jackson's life. He was also, at the same time he was in politics and in government, he was in business. And Jackson and his friends went to great lengths, particularly to get a bunch of Cherokee land along the Tennessee River that you see there. They obtained it from the Cherokees. It took an extraordinary effort to do. Once they got it, the land was put up for public auction. Jackson and his friends were able to obtain key parts of it and establish plantations worked by slaves throughout the region. They colonized the region. Some of them moved there. John Coffey, his best friend, moved there. James Jackson, another of his friends, moved there and built the plantation whose ruins we can still see at Forks of Cypress outside of town. They were creating a new world. They were creating a new city. They founded the city of Florence, Alabama. Have you been? It's a beautiful city. It's an amazing and vibrant city today. It's an impressive legacy. But it has this dark edge because of how the real estate was obtained. Throughout this period, Jackson was increasingly in conflict with John Ross, our other main character. And the thing that makes it really interesting to me is that Ross did not fight as other Indian leaders fought, by waging a rebellion, by killing people. He wanted in the system. And so he fought Jackson, the hero of democracy, in the emerging democratic system. Cherokees in this period recognized the emerging importance of the news media, and they started a newspaper. We all learn about this in school a line or two. You learn that there was something called the Cherokee Phoenix, and it was culturally important to the Cherokees because they had recently invented a written system for their language, a syllabary, which I'm probably not pronouncing correctly, but there must be a librarian here who will correct me later. And that was important. They had articles in Cherokee, but right next to them in the next column over would be articles in English. And those articles would be spread across the United States. The editor of the Cherokee Phoenix sent copies of the paper to as many as 100 other newspapers, by exchange, as it was called, which meant they'd send it to a newspaper in Nashville or send it to a newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina, or in Washington, D.C., and they'd get a newspaper back. That was good for the Cherokee Phoenix because then they could look at interesting articles and clip them out of the other paper and steal them and put them in the Cherokee Phoenix, which is what newspapers did in those days, sort of like the Huffington Post. Did I say that last part out loud? But the real powerful benefit was that the English language articles of the Cherokee Phoenix were getting to other newspapers read by the white community, and newspaper editors would sometimes reprint those articles or comment on them or respond to them favorably or unfavorably. And so the Cherokee Phoenix became like some blog or social media feed that the mainstream media would often pick up on. Sometimes their articles would go viral. The Cherokees were vastly outnumbered in a democratic society, didn't have the vote in federal elections anyway, but were making their case before the public. The Cherokees, recognizing that they were outnumbered, needed allies and got them. There were missionaries living in the Cherokee Nation, white missionaries, typically from New England, sometimes from elsewhere. And their job was to bring the word of God to heathens, as non-Christians were called. They were sometimes successful. Thousands of Cherokees converted to Christianity. But the Cherokees also flipped the missionaries and got them to bring the word of Cherokees back to the white community. The missionaries said the Cherokees were Christianizing and civilizing in the ways that we described, and that in any case they had rights that must be respected, that the Indian map was the governing map. This connected them to a powerful network of politicians and preachers and publishers who fought on their side. The Cherokees fought in the legislature, in Congress. They had allies there who gave eloquent speeches, and of course Jackson's allies gave powerful speeches as well. There was a very close vote over what became called the Indian Removal Act in 1830. When that failed for the Cherokees, they went to the United States Supreme Court and sued twice. And when that failed, they tried something that we could describe as civil disobedience. Now think about that for a minute. A racial minority that starts its own press, gathers white allies, fights in Congress, fights in the courts, tries civil disobedience. You could say the very same set of things about African Americans seeking civil rights on this same ground in the 20th century. African Americans realized they wanted their own newspapers and got them. There was a powerful paper called the Chicago Defender, just to give one example. And they reached out for white allies, often in the religious community, and got them. And they fought in Congress, and they fought in the courts, and when all else failed, there were acts of civil disobedience. It is, to me, a remarkable thing that faced with a democratic society and faced with an effort to gain their rights, Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders reached for many of the same tools that John Ross had done more than 100 years before. What we have here is, to me, a great example of how democracy works. Andrew Jackson, in my mind, represented a vital American principle, a vital democratic principle, majority rule, rule of the majority. And he would explicitly say this. He favored majority rule as long as it was exactly what he wanted. And it often was. If it wasn't, he believed it was anyway. He was about the will of the people, the will of the majority, and believed the people were with him. John Ross, in my mind, comes to represent an equally important democratic value, protection of the rights of a minority. Now, of course, minority rights have been around since the beginning of the country. That's what the Bill of Rights is all about. That's what the checks and balances throughout the Constitution are all about. But when I, as a layman, read some of the Founding Fathers' thoughts on minorities, it becomes clear to me that when they thought of minorities, what they often meant was the elites on top, the minority of people with money, did not want to risk having the masses vote away their money. And so they established a lot of protection for the minorities at the top. Here we have a man and a group of people arguing for the rights of a racial minority, arguing for the ability to keep their land. It was found to be their land. John Marshall, one of the great chief justices, possibly the greatest and most influential chief justice of all time, was an old man but still chief justice in 1832 when he ruled in a case called Worcester versus Georgia in favor of that map. He said it was blindingly obvious, there was no question. Indian nations, in Marshall's view, had come under the dominion of the United States. They had signed treaties with the United States. The treaties said that they were under the protection of the United States. Marshall was okay with the federal government being over the Indians. But the Constitution specifically said that was the business of the federal government. And what we had was states, particularly the state of Georgia, insisting that actually Georgia was going to be in charge of Indian land, that Georgia should govern and that Georgia should rule and Georgia should be able to enact laws even if they were repugnant to Cherokees and caused them to leave North Georgia. Marshall ruled against them, the state of Georgia, that is. The state of Georgia ignored the ruling. President Jackson, he was president at the time, denounced the ruling. There is a famous quote attributed to Jackson, something to the effect of, "Justice Marshall has made his ruling, now let him enforce it." Historians have looked into this and found no evidence that Jackson said exactly that. So we can defend him to that extent. Instead, he said four or five other things that essentially meant the same. And he didn't fully ignore the decision. He realized this was a potential constitutional crisis, ignoring the Supreme Court of the United States. So he delayed, did nothing for a while, and finally found some political machinations to make the case be dropped and make the case go away. The broader implications of Marshall's ruling were never enforced, at least not then. Eventually, a minority faction of Cherokees signed a removal treaty, and the Cherokees were ordered to go. Although at the end, they engaged in what I think of as civil disobedience. They simply declined to leave. They faced a deadline of May 23rd, 1838, to leave the Cherokee Nation and begin moving west. And in April of 1838, a federal official wrote a report and sent it to Washington with the disturbing information that he had seen Cherokees planting the corn crop as if they expected to be there in the fall, because their leader, John Ross, had told them they weren't going anywhere. Now, it's a dramatic and involved story. The Trail of Tears, of course, is what we're leading up to, the thing that we all learn at least a little bit about in school now. It's a more complicated story, I think, than we learn. The horrifying image that sticks with you, even if when you're a kid, is the idea of soldiers rousting peaceful people out of their homes and prodding them at bayonet point down the road. That actually did happen, but it almost did not. It nearly didn't have to happen that way because John Ross was in Washington, and the federal government, when they realized that the Cherokees were not going anywhere, that they were actually planting corn crops, that American soldiers were going to have to be used to prod them out, that a humanitarian disaster loomed, they finally negotiated with John Ross, who was able to improve the terms somewhat. Of course, the Cherokees were removed in the end. The other Indian nations were removed in various ways. And so this, if the clicker works, is what we have today. I didn't even press the button. You guys are awesome back there. This is what I think of as Jackson Land. This is an astonishing expanse of territory. This is all land that Andrew Jackson was personally involved in acquiring for the government of the United States. Part or all of multiple states. The entire state of Florida, big part of Georgia, most of Alabama, most of Mississippi, West Tennessee, a little bit of western Kentucky, even a bit of North Carolina. It's an incredible expanse. It's the size of a good-sized European nation. In fact, just one of these land acquisitions, which he obtained from the Creeks in 1814, is the land area the size of Scotland. Jackson, more than any other single person, did this and created this society, which is why his name is all over it. Jacksonville, Florida, Jackson, Mississippi, Jackson County, Alabama, Jackson County, North Carolina, Jacksonville, Alabama. I could go on for quite some time, but it's getting late. Jackson did this. He created this world. He created it through dark means. Although we cannot deny the power of this achievement, this is a region that has been vitally important to the politics and the culture of the United States ever since. What was happening here was poor white farmers were moving west. Wealthy plantation owners were also moving west. There were slave owners in Virginia who wanted to sell surplus slaves, and they needed a place to sell them, and so this land was acquired and filled with plantations. There were ordinary families and very wealthy entrepreneurs who were moving into this area and creating this world, which has stuck with us ever since. You cannot think about the politics of the United States without thinking of the powerful influence of these states, which go far beyond their electoral votes. You cannot think of the culture of the United States without these places. The home of William Faulkner, that is Jackson Land. The city where Rosa Parks refused to sit on the back of the bus, Jackson Land. Walt Disney World, Jackson Land. And I want to show you something else about Jackson Land. It was made by the tragic removal of Native Americans. And yet Jackson Land today, as some of you know, includes Native Americans. There still are Creeks in Alabama who returned in more recent times. There are Seminoles in Florida who, despite multiple brutal wars, are still there and have multiplied. There are Cherokees who resisted being removed in 1838, fled further into the mountains of North Carolina, and were able to remain. And just the other day, I was in Cherokee, North Carolina, talking about this same book. And it's an honor, by the way, to be in Cherokee, North Carolina and talk about this book, and be in Nashville and talk about this book and say roughly the same thing both places, and no one has challenged me to a duel. Yet. But a result of that is this next slide, which I saw on the way into Cherokee. Welcome to Jackson County, North Carolina. Welcome also to the Cherokee Indian Reservation. The dividing line is the same. There's a Cherokee reservation in Jackson County, which to me represents what this region is, in spite of the mistakes and tragedies of the past, an incredibly diverse region, a vital and dynamic place, and vital to our democracy. Now, there's one more thing I want to say before I invite your questions, and just a bit more that I want to read. The thing that I want to say is this. This region continues to change. We live in an extraordinarily diverse country that is only becoming more so, which is why, to me, it is vitally important to look back on this moment when our country, which was diverse in the early 19th century, was struggling with some of the same questions we face today. How do we make sure that everyone's individual rights are protected while also making sure that we fit together as one country? And the way that we do that, for better or worse, is continually fighting through the democratic system, arriving at a result, quite often a bad one, but the fight goes on. And over time, we may come up with a different and better result. It continues to become more interesting and more challenging. After I took that photo on the way into Cherokee, North Carolina, I went into Cherokee. And one of the things that you can see there is another set of signs. Let's take a look at this next slide. Here we are on Solly Boulevard in Cherokee, North Carolina. This is fascinating. People who once had to flee into the mountains and hide from soldiers, now their descendants can have a restaurant that is advertised as Indian-owned, where you can get Indian tacos, which are quite tasty. And you have Cherokee on the road signs. But this is the thing that's really striking to me, is this sign over here. Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, Sunday Mass, 9 a.m. Misa en Español, sábados a las 7. There's a Hispanic population in Cherokee, North Carolina. Your Indian taco may be served by a man who comes from Latin America. A man who comes from Latin America or a woman who comes from Latin America may also be working in the Giant Harris Casino in Cherokee, North Carolina. It is an incredible and diverse and rapidly changing place, and we will continually be challenged in our democratic system to referee those changes. I want to leave you with one final anecdote of this 20-year fight between Andrew Jackson and John Ross. In 1820, John Ross was a rising Cherokee leader. Andrew Jackson was a general in charge of the South. White intruders, as they were called, were moving onto Cherokee land in the Cherokee Nation. The Cherokees asked the army to kick them out. Jackson dragged his feet. He said he needed his troops for other purposes. He finally suggested the Cherokees do it themselves. They raised a military unit called the Cherokee Light Horse. John Ross was in command. And they traveled along the Tennessee River to a spot in Tennessee where they went to the farm of a man named Atkinson, a white man with his family who had moved onto Cherokee land and who had said that he would violently resist any effort to evict him. The Cherokee Light Horse approached his farm, ready for anything. They arrived at the farm and found it had been abandoned, perhaps just moments before. So with an eye on the surrounding countryside, they began to go about their work. They burned the food stores at that farm. That was their job. As his men set aflame the food stores at the farm, John Ross had been waiting for the response, the sound of hooves, the gunshot from the woods. But when at length he saw figures approaching, it was not a party of white gunmen. It was one man, one woman, and some children. Ross described this in a letter later on. Atkinson, he said, came across the river with his wife and family to defend it, not by the force of powder and lead, but by the shedding of tears. This unexpected weapon of defense had more effect on the minds of the men than if he had resorted to the measures threatened. His conviction of error and pitiful acknowledgement, etc., induced me to permit him to recross the river to the white side, unmolested with a few sheep and goats. His crop was all destroyed. Ross watched Atkinson go away, driving his livestock before him, probably all he owned. Though the strategy of gaining great strips of land for white settlement was a central project of the frontier elite, illegally occupying Indian land was a job for the poor. Not just any farmer would risk his life, labor, and possessions to improve land that might be snatched back. This white farmer had probably taken Cherokee property because he couldn't afford the abundant real estate on sale nearby in Alabama. Atkinson did not even have the support of relatives or other white Tennesseans. Nobody had rallied to help defend his farm. Surely his poverty was evident to Ross as soon as his weeping family appeared. Now, just a few years earlier, Ross had written a letter angrily denouncing this malicious class, as he called them, of white intruders. But now, finding himself with power over one such land grabber, he could summon no wrath. He showed as much mercy as circumstances allowed and went home and wrote a report about this to Andrew Jackson, General Jackson. While Jackson's reply to this note, if any, has not survived, it is easy to calculate from other letters what Jackson thought of it. He almost certainly disapproved. He would never have let Atkinson walk away. Jackson believed it was a mistake to allow white squatters to depart with their livestock. The squatters would simply wait until the troops had moved on and then return. While Jackson showed little enthusiasm for removing white settlers, he had none at all for doing a job badly or for giving anyone a chance to flout his will. If white settlers were to be removed at all, the job should be thoroughly and irresistibly done. Once his troops finally arrived, he would order them to hold white settlers and deliver them to the nearest civilian lawman for prosecution. Here was a subtle but significant difference between the two men who would contend over the many years that followed. Andrew Jackson could show mercy and respect. He could have empathy for others. He could never have succeeded as a politician otherwise. But these qualities were governed by his ruthlessness. He must never lose a fight. He must always uphold his authority. Ross, too, proved to be fiercely and stubbornly competitive. But there were moments when Ross let his stubbornness give way to generosity. And Ross hoped to justice. The book is Jacksonland, and I'm honored that you've come out here this evening to talk about it. And now I want to invite you into our conversation and take a few questions before we go away. Denunciations, challenges to duels, anything that you'd like. All I'd ask if you have a question is just raise your hand and say your name, maybe stand up so that we get to know each other just a little bit and let me know what's on your mind. Anyone want to go first? Really? Yes, ma'am, please stand. Here we go.
Maybe you can, or repeat it.
Your name is Maya, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Maya, hello. When the Supreme Court upheld the Indian map, but then it was pretty much ignored, do you feel that that was a success for democracy or a failure for democracy?
Well, it seems to have been a failure for democracy. And that ruling still stands, and it governs conduct today. And maybe that is the way to think about democracy in this case, is by taking the long view. It clearly was a failure at the time, but it was the finding of Justice John Marshall. And today, well over a century later, we have a different circumstance, which is not perfect by any means, but if we just think about Native Americans and Native American rights, part of that story is disastrous and tragic. If you go to a reservation in many parts of the United States, you will find some of the poorest people in America. So the policies have not been perfect by any means. But you do have a situation in which Indians are now citizens of the United States. They are part of the broader republic. They got what John Ross wanted for them. But they also have such pieces of sovereignty that different tribes and nations have never surrendered. And that sovereignty is respected in places like Cherokee, North Carolina. And that, to me, is what democracy is about, is imperfect people battling it out against each other in the democratic system and quite often failing, but the argument goes on. You know, I've heard a number of politicians over the years say something that when I first heard it seemed discouraging, and it's a lesson of politics, the lesson being that nothing is ever over. That's frustrating if you're the congressman who just won, as your congressman must know. Nothing is ever over. But that can also be a good thing and a great strength, because even when the decision seems to be wrong or only partially right, we're going to argue it over again and hopefully get a little better and a little better over time. Think about the difference between the Cherokee result and the African American result a century later, using many of the same tactics in the same system. Yes, sir.
That was my question. Well, how come the Indian rights movement failed and the civil rights movement seemingly did well or better?
There are many reasons for that. One is simply the complexity of the issues. We are talking about owning strips of land, which was not necessarily an issue in the civil rights movement in the 20th century. But another underlying reason, I think, is this. It had to do with the underlying racial attitudes of the time. And it's really remarkable to read the letters of that time and to get a sense of what people thought of Indians, including their supporters. People who vocally supported the Indian cause and were openly sympathetic to it quite often nevertheless believed that Native Americans were a doomed race, an inferior race, children of the woods, unfortunate savages, and even when they became civilized, they were still described as nomads. Henry Clay, a hero of mine when I was growing up, I read some of his letters here, he was a supporter of the Cherokee cause, but was noted in a private meeting saying that Indians were probably doomed to extinction and that their loss would be no great loss to the world. So we have a situation where in a democracy you needed to have white allies, and the white allies were sort of self-defeated by their own attitudes. They weren't really going to fight all that hard because it seemed like a lost cause anyway. Racial attitudes also drove the other side. There was an argument embraced by Andrew Jackson, by the way, and even by some of the Cherokee's own supporters and other Indian supporters, that they were being destroyed by their contact with white civilization, that they were being destroyed by alcohol and by land grabbing and all of the mercenary influences, as Jackson called them, of white civilization right next door. And that it would be so much better for Indians if they were segregated. This was a gigantic segregation of the continent, moving an entire group of people somewhere else far across the river. And the idea was that they could perpetuate their own races or race there. By the 20th century, it seems clear that racial attitudes were changing. That notion of inferior races, which you will still find today, of course, was becoming somewhat less prevalent and a lot less acceptable. And it became possible for someone to fight in Congress and rather than just barely lose the vote, to actually win. It became possible to have Brown versus Board of Education, and there was great turmoil and resistance to it on the state level, much like the Supreme Court ruling in 1832, but the federal government insisted on enforcing that rule. And rather than sending the troops in to do the opposite of the court's ruling, sending the troops in to enforce the court's ruling. Underlying racial attitudes had changed in the intervening 100-plus years. And quite possibly part of that had to do with information, what was available. There was more of it. There was better information. People were a little better informed. Other questions? Yes, ma'am, right here. Go ahead and stand up. Say your name. Say your name. And we have a microphone there.
My name is Michelle.
Hi.
Did you visit the home of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma near Tahlequah in your studies?
No, ma'am. I gave a lot of thought to that, and I decided that my story was Jackson Land, that my story was here. I did my research in a few places. One was the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., which is extraordinary and has incredible documents. And you can read original letters of Andrew Jackson. You start with those volumes from the University of Tennessee, and they have thousands of letters. And when that's not enough, you go into microfilm, and they have more letters. And when that's not enough, and the librarians finally figure out what you're working on, they point you to this door you never noticed and tell you to go through, and then you go through another door, and then you talk to a woman named Barbara, and Barbara brings you to this other guy, and the other guy brings you these red leather volumes, and in them are pasted actual letters of Andrew Jackson. And suddenly you're looking at a 200-year-old letter to his wife. John Ross's papers can also be found, not the originals, but copies in volumes at the Library of Congress and many other original sources. And then I went driving. I went driving across much of Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama. I drove to Nuwachota, which was the Cherokee capital in Georgia, and which you can visit today. I drove to a surviving house of John Ross in Rossville, Georgia. I went to the Walnut Street Bridge in Chattanooga, where you can look down on the spot that was Ross's Landing, a ferry crossing that he ran. I went to Rome, Georgia, where John Ross had a home, along with other Cherokee leaders. They were removed from their homes. There's now a city there. It's a beautiful and vibrant city, and there's a cigar bar there with a wooden Indian in the window. I went down the Tennessee Valley, which is astonishing and beautiful, and spent a little time in Florence. And along the way, I was so gratified that people in the places I went were so into history, which I think is something that is really precious and valuable, especially about the South. People are interested in history everywhere, but I feel it's especially powerful here. And you go to Florence and you go to the public library, and you don't have everything you want in the public library, but the guy says, well, talk to Millie, this local historian. So you call Millie, and she says, come right over. And you go to her house, and she says, this house was built in the 1820s by a friend of Andrew Jackson, this house that I live in now. And I don't actually know, but he might have had dinner here or something. And I've been researching real estate transactions in this area for years. I've got thousands of pages of documents. Would you like copies? I mean, that's a great thing as a journalist that you can do in the South, like almost nowhere else. You can go covering a 200-year-old story and find people to interview. And I also went to Cherokee, North Carolina the same way. I decided my story was here and not there. I've been invited. I've been invited, actually, to the Gilcrease Museum. I haven't been able to work out when, but I hope to be able to do it. Yes, ma'am, right here.
When you're there, you should talk to Gail Ross, who's his granddaughter.
Oh,
she's
yes.
She's a storyteller.
We are Facebook pals.
Oh, good. When we did some research for a unit we were doing for eighth graders, and we read the Supreme Court.
Sounds like you're
Court,
a teacher, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We read the Supreme Court, the document of the arguments.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that we were struck by was how much, you were talking about history repeating itself, but how much the groundwork for the Civil War was already in action.
Yes.
And that it was almost like a preliminary event.
I feel like it was.
Yeah.
I feel like it was. This is a prequel to the Civil War, this story, because what's being created before our eyes is the South as it was by the time of the Civil War. Jackson did a lot of it, And proteges of Andrew Jackson, people like James K. Polk and Sam Houston, did the rest. The South was being created, and so the stage was being set for the Civil War. And when you read this book, you'll find a lot of the conflict is North versus South. The Christian groups that took the side of the Cherokees tended to be in the North.
And also states' rights.
The states' rights people tended to be in the South. Now, we should be careful about this, because this is a situation where it is easy, if you're from Massachusetts or New York, to feel that you were moral and on the right side. And in light of history, they were. But this is also a case of economic interests. And it's hard not to notice that New York congressmen found it easy to speak on support, in support of the Indians and their rights, because New York had long ago gotten rid of most of their Indians. So we don't want to be too judgmental of anyone, particularly in this situation, but brutal things were done. And it was, you're right, a prelude to the Civil War and a prelude to the democratic debates of our era. I mean, I read there's this famous message, or famous to me anyway, message by George M. Troop, who was a governor of Georgia in 1825. And he's got this letter to the legislature, so it's a public message. And he's speaking in the language of the time, so I'm paraphrasing loosely. But I read this letter, and he's saying, Washington elites are coming after our state. We've got these liberal judges on the Supreme Court, these unelected judges and these New York lawmakers and this untrustworthy president, and they're coming after to destroy everything that's valuable in the southern country. Now, the thing he was afraid of was that they would come and take Georgia's slaves and not pay for them. There was no danger of that in 1825. And aside from the rhetoric that I just mentioned, the kind of sense of paranoia is also very present and very constant in American politics. And it's okay. We should be worried. We should be fearful. We should be thinking about our liberties. But we should also be thoughtful about how we do that. And you do see the preludes of other conflicts. Looks like the microphone has moved right there. Go right ahead. Stand up.
I, just skimming through the book here, noticed that you...
Had a typo?
No. I haven't found that yet. Women were able to kind of get behind this as a cause, and one of the first things, I guess, they participated sort of en masse, and could you touch on that a little bit?
Thank you. That was a great discovery to me. I was not aware of this. There were women who got involved in a way they'd never gotten involved before. They were connected to some of the Christian organizations that I mentioned, and there was a woman named Catherine Beecher, who was an educator at the time, who organized a group of women. They wrote something called that came to be known as the Ladies' Circular. It was an appeal on behalf of the Southern Indians. They wrote this in Connecticut and mailed it almost like a chain letter to people they knew across much of the United States, particularly the North and a little bit of the what is now the Midwest. And this triggered people to hold meetings, to sign petitions, to send the petitions to Congress. And so even though women could not vote, they were insisting on making their voices heard. Now, they failed, but it changed people's thinking. Many of the politicians, publishers, preachers who spoke against Indian removal, and some of the women who spoke against Indian removal, began thinking about another racial issue differently and became among the early leaders in the movement to abolish slavery in the United States. Catherine Beecher's little sister, Harriet, as Harriet Beecher Stowe, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, the novel describing slavery that did as much as any document did to bring about the Civil War. So it is an incredible story, and I believe the first mass political action by women in the United States. This is years and years before the Seneca Falls Convention and other events that you hear about in the women's rights movement. One more question. Oh, go right ahead.
My name is Laura.
Hi, Laura.
In your research for your book, I wondered, you mentioned several times about not repeating the past. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have a sense for whether the current American Indian Territory is safe.
Yeah.
Because I've read some things to the contrary lately.
Well, now you're talking, there are some specific instances which we could discuss. As a broad principle, it's there. I don't think that Cherokee sovereignty is going away in Cherokee, North Carolina, for example. In fact, when I was in North Carolina, I met people who are involved in passing governmental functions back from the state and the county level to the eastern band of the Cherokees there as their government becomes more capable. We could go out west and find other issues. There was a story in the papers the other day about a spot in Arizona that is a holy site, but that also has mining potential. And they'll continue battling this out. That's something that we'll have to fight about in the democratic process. The last thing I'll say is this. It involves, if you'll excuse me, this guy, Andrew, there has been a movement this year, and it's been a very powerful and impressive movement to remove President Jackson from the $20 bill, the Women on the 20s movement. You guys are familiar with this? Does anybody like this? Yeah? Yeah? Go ahead. I think it's a brilliant political movement. It causes me to say several things, however. One is to recognize what's behind it. Of course, there should be diversity on the currency, I say, as a father of daughters. So it's great. And I understand why they targeted Andrew Jackson. It's because of his treatment of Native Americans. A couple of points should be made, however. This brilliant campaign, which I really like, it's an online election. They got something like 250,000 or more people to participate and vote, and they ended up voting for Harriet Tubman to be on the 20. Who knows if that will ever happen, but it got lots of attention. In other words, they were using the democratic process. They were making innovative use of the media. They were gathering attention and gathering public support and making their argument before the public. So if they succeed in getting Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill, they will owe a debt to Andrew Jackson, who did so much to innovate the democratic process that they're now working within very interestingly and effectively. I had my own proposal, by the way, of what to do with the $20 bill. I wrote about this, maybe some of you saw in the New York Times a few weeks ago. My idea was to put John Ross on the $20 bill and then put Andrew Jackson on the other side of the same bill. The reason is, first, because I think this is a vitally important story. I was talking with a Cherokee woman in Cherokee a few days ago, and she was saying, you know, I grew up despising Andrew Jackson. My dad taught me to draw by defacing $20 bills. She described this in great detail. It was remarkable. And she said, but it bothers me when I think of him being removed from the bill for Harriet Tubman or somebody, because that changes the subject away from the story that is important to me, a Cherokee. And I don't think we should change the subject. This is such an important era that's so vital to us all. I think we need to recognize the value of Jackson as a leader of his time. I think we also have to correctly and accurately and ruthlessly note the truths of what he did wrong. I think we have to acknowledge that John Ross was far from perfect. He, like Jackson, was a slave owner, by the way. Putting them both on the bill ceases to make it about either man as a great man of history. It then is a story. Putting them together tells the story of their conflict within the democratic system. And we could do that with other bills so that they represent the incredible diversity of this country. Ulysses S. Grant, he's on the $50 bill. His armies won the Civil War. That's great. On the flip side could be Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose novel did at least as much to start the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln is on the $5 bill. Of course he belongs there. Flip it over. On the other side, you could have Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave who prodded Lincoln to move faster than he did to end slavery. You could go through the entire currency this way. And then what each bill would be about is not some great figure necessarily, but about democracy itself. The system that is what America really is all about. Thank you very much. Thank you.